Yeah, we'll get some volunteers to hand them out.
Hello, good evening, folks.
Welcome to this evening's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. Dallas Philosophers Forum is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to the mission of providing a forum for the discussion and dissemination of philosophical ideas for the interested public in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. As an organization, we promote no particular doctrine or set of propositions, but we try to provide a forum where we can come and learn and understand about different viewpoints. And we will follow our format of about approximately 1 hour lecture, and then we'll have a half an hour for Q&A. We do need to vacate the room by about 9 o'clock so they can clean up here. They'll be trying to close the restaurant down. And if you ordered food, make sure that you don't leave the premises without finding your bill and settling that, because we do kind of move around and come at different times. It's a little bit hard for the waitstaff to track us. But we do ask you to take care of that detail and to be kind to your waitstaff and tip generously. And we take a $5 entry fee to help defray our expenses of publicity and equipment and things such as that. And if you want to be a regular, for $35, you can have a six-month subscription and save almost half of the price. I think that's pretty much our announcements other than the events at hand. We're privileged to have with us tonight Dr. Christopher Cohn, who is the president of the Tyndale Theological Seminary, which is in Hearst, Texas, in Tarrant County. And he'll be presenting to us on the topic of considering metaphysical presuppositions to environmental thought. And we have a handout here, if we could have a couple volunteers and start those around so we can follow along. Dr. Cohn?
Well, good evening. My fellow Americans, oh wait, wrong speech. I tried to get him to move his speech to another night, but he wouldn't cooperate. So I'll wait just a moment for the handouts to move around, but just a quick little bit of background. I've got a couple of doctorates in Bible and theology, and decided I wanted to also do a PhD in philosophy. I'm a glutton for punishment, but I believe that regardless of where we're at on our personal beliefs or ideas, we need to be able to interact with each other, and we need to study honestly and openly the views of each other. So I'm really honored and excited to be with you this evening. And I understood that I would have about 40 minutes to speak, so I've kind of scheduled along those lines. But always the discussion is the fun part, so I'll try not to bore you to death. And if anyone has any questions or comments, even as I'm working through this, I'd rather deal with them while you're thinking of them. So feel free to just raise your hand and we'll stop and deal with that. But I am dealing this evening with metaphysical presuppositions in environmental thought. And it's metaphysical presuppositions that really kind of set the tone for a lot of differences that we'll have, different ideas and different thoughts on things. And especially in respect to how we view the environment and our responsibility to the environment. So I wanted to visit with you about those issues tonight. So everyone should have a handout, I hope. And on this, these are basic notes that work from some of the quotes and some of the ideas we'll focus on. I know it won't make any sense if you just read through these notes, and it's by design, so you have to pay attention to me. But we'll work through that, and I hope these notes will make sense for you. Also, if anybody is particularly interested in the transcript or the paper that I'm going to be working with tonight, I do post it on my website, which is drcone.com, drcone.com. So later time, if you want to look at that, you're welcome to. But otherwise, you've got the notes in front of you. Now, let's jump in. Noted environmental philosopher J. Bear Calicott. How many of you have heard of Calicott? Okay, he's up at UNT. He's a world-renowned environmental philosopher. But he recognized that to affect change in both individual behavior and social, political, and economic institutions, we have to do more than preach and browbeat, analyze, and reform. He observes that as individual persons and as complex societies, we operate within distinct intellectual and moral atmospheres. Further, he prescribes that we must deliberately explore the contours of an ecological consciousness and conscience. We must, in other words, also work at articulating an environmental ethic, he says. Now, at the dinner table a short while ago, a gentleman asked me, now, why'd you get into the environment? Knowing maybe some of my theological background, let's face it, Christians aren't noted for traditionally for their environmental concerns. Personally, I want to do some things to change that. But my answer is, as to why I'm concerned about the environment, is because I'm in it, right? We're all a part of this thing, and so it's worth thinking about, worth dealing with. And as Calicott observes, this is not something that we're able to beat each other over the head and resolve and derive common ground that way. He's calling for articulating an environmental ethic which has many, many layers and many facets. Now, I have a great deal of respect for Calicott, even though we differ on many things, but we also have a lot in common. In any case, in consideration of Calicott's exhortation for multiculturally considered environmental sensitivities, this particular presentation is going to examine foundational contours of environmental conscience. Specifically, we'll assess the role of metaphysical presuppositions in formulating environmental ethics. Such presuppositions are foundational, oftentimes forming the first descriptive premise of any argument for ethical responsibility. But, as Hume's is-ought dichotomy cautions, it is with care that we must proceed from descriptive to prescriptive. Now, how many of you are familiar with Hume's is-ought problem? Okay, some of you. We'll get into that here at length. First, this discussion considers Hume's statement of the problem and examines a solution to it, and then works with Hume's framework of argument to compare two competing metaphysical presuppositions, and then we assess the environmental ethics that can come from that, can stem from that. So first, let's look at David Hume's is-ought problem or dichotomy. Okay, he questioned the relationship of is to ought in a pivotal paragraph in his treatise on human nature, and I've got that duplicated here, and I want to read through it and spend a moment here. He says, "In every system of morality which I have hitherto met with," okay, so he's talking about ethical systems, "I have always remarked that the author proceeds for some time in the ordinary way of reasoning and establishes the being of God or makes observations concerning human affairs, when of a sudden," and this is the key, he says, "I am surprised to find that instead of the usual copulations of propositions, is and is not, I meet with no proposition that is not connected with an ought or an ought not." In other words, these thinkers start with is. They start with describing how things are, and then they move to, now we ought to do this, we should do this or that. And Hume, as a skeptic, as a naturalistic, you could even say materialistic in the non-metaphysical sense, skeptic, he is particularly taking aim at theistic thinkers and theistic ethicists, those who are deriving ethics from divine mandate or the like. So he marvels a bit at this shift from is to ought, and what he's saying is that move from is to ought isn't warranted. It's not justified in these thinkers or by these thinkers. He says, "I meet with no proposition that is not connected with an ought or an ought not. This change is imperceptible but is, however, of the last consequence, meaning the final consequence or the most important consequence. For as this ought or ought not expresses some new relation or affirmation, it is necessary that it should be observed and explained. So what he's calling for is transparency. If you're going to move from is to ought, you need to explain how you got there. There needs to be some solid, warranted, justifiable bridge between descriptive and prescriptive. Okay? So he says it should be observed and explained, and at the same time that a reason should be given for whatever seems altogether inconceivable, how this new relation can be a deduction from others which are entirely different from it. Okay? So what he's looking for is an explanation of the move from descriptive to prescriptive. This is how things are, therefore we have to act in a certain manner. He's saying that is typically not earned. Now, in grand hypocritical fashion, Hume himself will give prescriptions, but he kind of gives us a model for how to overcome his problem. And it is built on a non-metaphysical framework, but we'll get into that. So the is-ought problem is a really key component of what we're talking about. So let me just, before we go any further, let me just ask any questions on is-ought? This problem with moving from descriptive to prescriptive, does that make sense? Okay, let's move forward. Yes, sir?
But it does mean that is not ought.
Exactly. He's saying is not ought, nor does it directly lead to ought, right? So if I'm going to move from is to ought, I've then got to justify and be open about how I'm getting there. And he's suggesting especially that the theistic thinkers are not doing that. Okay, and I think, by the way, that he is correct. But we move on. Hume critiques here the idea that reason directly governs ethics, particularly taking aim at those who on metaphysical grounds argue that is leads to ought. Callicott rightly observes that Hume's is-ought dichotomy is a challenge that has haunted academic environmental ethics and threatens to be its Achilles heel. Now, out of curiosity, why would that be? Why would Callicott say that this is-ought problem is a central difficulty in academic environmental ethics? Any ideas? Does it surprise anyone? Well, the reason he says this is because environmental ethics is grounded on the idea of describing what is and placing us in a community as kind of co-heirs of the cosmos, so to speak. And consequently, it represents an is. And the core of environmental ethics is prescriptive. Right? The nature of ethics is prescriptive. So it's at its core prescriptive, and it is that based upon assessments of actuality, determinations of what is. So the problem for ethics is that in addition to the first descriptive premise, is, and the final prescriptive conclusion, ought, there is an unstated assumed premise that must be identified and justified if an is-ought argument is to be warranted. Now, we'll get into some examples of this and kind of flesh this out, but Hume justifies his own ethical structure on grounds that feeling, rather than reason, governs the issue. He's emphatic in this regard, saying, for example, and this quote is on your page, actions may be laudable or blamable, but they cannot be reasonable. Laudable or blamable, therefore, are not the same as reasonable or unreasonable. The merit and demerit of actions frequently contradict and sometimes control our natural propensities, but reason has no such influence. Moral distinctions, therefore, are not the offspring of reason. Reason is wholly inactive and can never be the source of so active a principle as conscience or a sense of morals. So rather than a set of descriptive propositions giving rise to a reasoned descriptive conclusion, Hume understands that feeling offers the missing piece in the argument. In other words, reason doesn't get us to an ought. Reason gets us to an is, but can't get us to an ought. Feeling, or as he'll describe it, moral sentiment, gets us to the ought. He understands that feeling offers this missing piece in the argument. He considers moral sentiment to be as universal and normative to the human condition as the physical features whereby we recognize a human. And of course, there are exceptions to that. We could say that, for example, a person normally has two legs, right? But not all people have two legs. And so, for those who might not, it represents an exception to the rule. Likewise, Hume acknowledges that there are exceptions to this universal, which accounts for those that don't have this sense of moral sentiment are psychopathic in that sense. So there are exceptions to these general rules. Let's illustrate this, okay? First, we'll look at a premise and a conclusion, and it's a problematic one because it falls into Hume's trap. It doesn't supply the missing pivotal premise. Look at it, the first premise conclusion here. Premise: eating too much candy is unhealthy. That's an is or a descriptive statement, right? Conclusion: we should not eat too much candy. Ought or prescriptive? Okay. Now that sounds, especially as the father of two young girls, this sounds like a very legitimate thing to say, right? That you shouldn't eat candy because too much candy, because eating too much candy is unhealthy, right? But Hume is saying this is an unwarranted, unjustified, wrong-headed kind of statement. Okay. So let's look at what's wrong with it. The question that's left unanswered by this argument is why we should not prefer to be unhealthy, right? That's the assumed premise. If we look at premise being eating too much candy is unhealthy, and conclusion, we should not eat too much candy, why shouldn't we eat too much candy? Well, because obviously the assumed premise is we'll be unhealthy, and being unhealthy is bad. But why is being unhealthy bad? He's saying you can't reason your way to that answer. He says that there's something missing. So the question left unanswered is why we should not prefer to be unhealthy. And here's another problematic example, the next set of premises and conclusion. And in this example, we supply a reasonable premise. But let's see if it's enough. Premise one, eating too much candy is unhealthy. Premise two, it is bad to be unhealthy. Conclusion, we should not eat too much candy. Okay, so it reasons out the issues, and now we understand the proposition that it is bad to be unhealthy. The earlier question, though it's now addressed in the second argument with a reasonable premise, has not yet been answered. We now understand it may be bad to be unhealthy, but we don't yet know why the description of unhealthy as bad must suggest that we should do anything. So there remains an assumed premise implying bad as an action point. Hume argues this can't be supplied by reason. Instead, he might frame the argument like this. Look at the next example. Eating too much candy, premise one, eating too much candy is not healthy. Premise two, we view being unhealthy negatively or with bad sentiments. Conclusion, we should not eat too much candy. There's an assumption there. If we do not wish to violate our universal moral sentiments. Okay? Is this making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the first premise, eating too much candy is not healthy. We can discern that pretty easily, right? Figuring out what is, it's not that difficult. Science, for example, is pretty good at this. Not perfect, but it's pretty good at this. But the second issue, the second premise, that we view being unhealthy negatively, that is decidedly unscientific. Okay? Not to say it's anti-scientific, but it's just unrelated. It's a different category. Hume argues this, okay? Hume is suggesting that this is based on sentiment, that an action point is driven by feeling rather than reason. Now, he's not saying it's contrary to reason. He's just saying that reason isn't dispositive. It's not going to determine the outcome. Instead, Feeling determines the outcome, and reason agrees with feeling. Okay? So that's Hume's basic idea here. So the end goal here for Hume is not to establish a necessary connection via reason between is and ought. Instead, he interjects moral sentiment as the only reliable justifier for ethical prescription. So when we go back to this syllogism and we see eating too much candy is not healthy, premise two, we view being unhealthy negatively, that negative view, that moral sentiment is the suitable or warranted justifier for an action point, for a prescriptive statement. So for Hume, he justifies his ethical framework by inserting this second premise, this aspect of moral sentiment as the determining factor of good and bad and right and wrong, rather than reason. So he's not trying to elevate reason. Obviously, he is elevating experience and the sentiment here. So finally, though, it's important for us to recognize that for Hume, and I say finally in respect to the discussion of Hume, I'm not trying to scare you yet. Finally, it's important to recognize that for Hume, the moral determination was not made by the agent, or the one acting. Okay? And it was also not to be made by the receiver. But instead, it's made by the spectator. Now, in this terminology, Hume is borrowing this from others, kind of standing on the shoulders of others. But in this sense, what he's doing, if you look at the syllogism, he's suggesting, premise one, eating too much candy is not healthy. So if we watch somebody eating too much candy and becoming unhealthy, the agent is not objective in the sense that his sentiments are pure. He may be deceived in his sentiments, let's say, and not able to make an accurate determination of the ethical quality of his action. In this case, there's really no receiver. Let's just change the illustration for a moment. Let's say that I walked over and punched Jack in the nose, okay? Which I promised not to do, but let's just say I did, all right? As the agent, I would probably feel like I have a pretty good reason to do that, right? And so I am not I'm not in a position to make an objective judgment of the ethical quality of that action because I'm the one doing the action. I've got a presupposition about the quality of that action, or I wouldn't have done it, right? Now, Jack is also not in a position to make this determination because he's the one being acted upon, right? And he also has a predisposition to not perceiving this as a quality ethical act, right? So who makes the decision? The spectator. You all. And the decision is not made based on reason, moving from is to ought, without an unearned, or I should say with an unearned transition. Instead, that decision is to be made based on sentiment, based on your feeling about what you have witnessed. Okay, this is Hume's approach. So for Hume, again, he's elevating feeling and sentiment, experience, over reason, not discarding reason and not saying this is contrary to reason, but reason plays a complementary role here.
Question.
Yes, sir.
What if I take the attitude that my sentiment is that I want the candy now, and yeah, I don't care about health?
Good. That is the assumed...
Is that unreasonable, or is my sentiment...
Well, that's actually almost a very good pun right there to put it that way. For Hume, what he's trying to do is to make it objective, but outside of reason. It's a very interesting thing that he's doing. You see, if you want the candy, you're obviously not concerned about your health, right? But you're not the one making the moral decision because you have a conflict of interest, right? You're getting into greater goods here. This is a whole other discussion. But because you are going after a whim and not a sentiment, let's say, you're not looking at the pure feeling of the issue. You're instead pursuing a base desire, let's say, for the sugar high, right, or whatever you want to say. So you're just not equipped to make the moral determination in this situation because you've got that conflict of interest. So you may do it, and you may justify it in your own mind, but Hume would say you are not in a position to make that ethical judgment, so someone else has to do that. The spectator, the kind of innocent bystander who has a feeling about what you're doing, that's the one that makes the decision. Does that work? So he takes...
It was always in the innocent bystander.
Exactly. That's the key. So he takes the burden off of the agent and the receiver to make the determination. Good. Excellent. So this is really important, and this comes into play when we get into the metaphysics of environmental ethics later on, because I will borrow Hume's idea, but we'll get into that. Okay, so the impartial observer is the key here. The impartial observer is the one who's affected by this universal moral sentiment. And now the obvious question or argument against Hume would be, well, wait a minute, we've got however many people in this room, and perhaps some might actually like to see Jack punched in the nose by a guest speaker, right? Perhaps. And so, yes, and he's looking around to see whom that might be. Now, the challenge there would be, there are different perspectives, right? But what Hume is talking about is a universal moral sentiment. He's working from a non-metaphysical framework, and he's working from the perspective that we all share moral sentiments. See? I got your attention now. I'll do it again if I see you falling asleep. Okay? So we share these basic ideas, Hume argues. Now again, he's coming from a non-metaphysical framework. But what we're going to do is we're going to take Hume's, what I'll call an axiom here, okay? His form of syllogism that justifies in his system, his ethics. And we're going to borrow it and apply it to a non-metaphysical environmental ethic and a metaphysical environmental ethic. And what I'm going to show you is it works. Okay? So that's where we're headed. But first, let's formalize Hume's three-step approach, and then we'll apply it. Okay? So you see on the bottom of page one of your notes, the very last syllogism here, premise one is the descriptive statement. Insert is statement here, right? Insert description here. Okay? We're talking form, not content, right? So premise one would be the descriptive statement. Premise two is the moral assessment by Hume's spectator. Not the moral assessment by the agent or the receiver, but the moral assessment by the spectator. And it's based upon universal moral sentiment. That's premise two. The conclusion, then, is the prescriptive statement. Okay? So we're going to work with this axiom and just see where it takes us as it relates to environmental ethics. Now, I should earn some credit in your eyes as being a guy who works from a metaphysical framework as a theologian and a biblicist who can be very comfortable with Hume's methodology. It's a little ironic and kind of humorous, but anyway, so give me some credit. But anyway, thank you. Very nice, very nice. Anyway, Hume is very intriguing in this regard, and I think even using his approach, we can have a good dialogue about environmental ethical systems. So, in talking about Hume's worldview, it's obvious that his ethical construct is preloaded with a naturalistic worldview, and it was well intended to support that worldview. Charles Darwin, for example, illustrates the compatibility of Hume's non-metaphysical model to Darwinian materialism when he describes the origin of ethics in very similar terms. He attributes the development of social values and virtues to the love of approbation and the dread of infamy, which derived from the instinct of sympathy, he says, and which was originally acquired through natural selection. He further poignantly noted, even dogs appreciate encouragement, praise, and blame. And I can confirm that. He observed, it is obvious that members of the same tribe would approve of conduct which appeared to them to be for the general good and would reprobate that which appeared evil. Evil not meaning metaphysical evil, but evil meaning not good for the tribe. Darwin speaks of the utilitarian benefits of virtue to the tribe. He does so in materialistic terms. Nonetheless, applying Hume's three-step axiom is a very interesting prospect, both for naturalistic and metaphysically grounded ethics. So first, we consider a naturalistic model. Although Leopold's land ethic fits Hume's framework well. Now, the land ethic, how many of you have heard of Aldo Leopold? He's an early environmental thinker, materialistic, and at the same time, both irreverent and reverent towards metaphysics. Very, very interesting guy. But his environmental ethic is commonly known as the land ethic, and it's a very popular one in environmental thought. His ethic is best summarized perhaps by a couple of remarks he makes in the introduction to his Sand County Almanac, which is his pivotal work. He says, first of all, conservation is getting nowhere because it is incompatible with our Abrahamic concept of land. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. There's no other way for land to survive the impact of mechanized man, nor for us to reap from it the aesthetic harvest it is capable under science of contributing to culture. So his target here is the Abrahamic concept, of course, the Judeo-Christian framework, and he's saying that there is an is problem. Okay. First, Leopold observes here a repudiation of a Judeo-Christian perspective toward land. It's a perspective that Leopold believes leads to abuse. Instead, Leopold prefers the perception that land and human are co-citizens of a biotic community. He follows that particular warning with a description and prescription that at first glance may seem guilty of the is-ought junk. Here's what he says. And again, this is reproduced on page 2 of your notes. That land is a community is the basic concept of ecology. But that land is to be loved and respected is an extension of ethics. That land yields a cultural harvest is a fact long known but latterly often forgotten. These essays that he's writing attempt to weld these three concepts. So Leopold purposes to join three ideas. Number one, land is community. Number two, land should be loved and respected. Number three, a revisiting of the benefactions of land. In other words, the benefits that land provides. And while Leopold does assert both an is, land is community, and an ought, we ought to love and respect land, he includes a third element that justifies his model with Hume's axiom. Hume requires the intermediary moral judgment by the spectator based on universal moral sentiment. Leopold provides that, though he does that only generally. His argument for the land ethic might look something like this. Premise one, land is community. Premise two, the spectator views the functions and contributions of the land to the community with positive sentiment and would view the lack thereof with negative sentiment. So Leopold offers, vaguely, but he offers that premise. And then the conclusion, land should be loved and respected. So Leopold's argument is compatible with Hume's model, both in form and substance. In form, it adds the missing premise in order to avoid the is-ought jump. In substance, it's consistent with a naturalistic ethic because it relies on a third-party spectator who needs no divine origins or mandate. Leopold's land ethic is an appealing and cogent prescription based on a non-metaphysical premise. Okay, so it works. It works within Hume's framework, and it's very effective. Now, again, the Abrahamic perspective that he critiques is that same Judeo-Christian premise that Lynn White vilifies, specifically the interpretation that the Genesis account grants humankind a lasting and comprehensive dominion over creation, resulting in, as White puts it, the most anthropocentric religion the world has seen. Such heavy-handed anthropocentrism does not offer much promise for a metaphysically grounded biblical environmental ethic. Lots of problems with it. As a Bible expositor, I find more problems with the dominionist interpretation besides the anthropocentric ramifications. The interpretation also fails to account for the fall described in Genesis 3 and the adjustments, the cosmological adjustments in chapters 3 through 9. In light of the anthropocentric implications of the dominionist interpretation, okay, so now we're looking at the metaphysical framework, and we've seen, first of all, dominionist interpretation, which the environmental ethicists have harshly critiqued, and I would say to a point accurately. But in light of these anthropocentric challenges, a number of Bible interpreters have proposed a stewardship interpretation of the early Genesis account. This stewardship interpretation softens the terminology in Genesis 1:26-28 to reflect stewardship rather than dominion. Okay, two different strengths of terminology. This interpretation lessens the anthropocentric implications, but doesn't escape them entirely. It still asserts that mankind is the centerpiece, and that there's still a lasting superiority over the rest of nature. Further, this interpretation also faces hermeneutic challenges, being somewhat at odds with the literal grammatical historical interpretive method to which its advocates often appeal. Those that hold to a stewardship interpretation generally will interpret the Bible literally, and personally I would make the case that in arguing for stewardship, there is a slight abandonment of that hermeneutic or interpretive method. So it's, I would argue, perhaps an inconsistent position. And if inconsistent's okay, then that's okay, but that seems problematic. Elsewhere, I have proposed an interpretation of the early Genesis account that remains true to the literal grammatical historical hermeneutic method, accounts for the cataclysmic changes in Genesis 3 through 9, and is decidedly theocentric, meaning God-centered rather than man-centered, anthropocentric. I refer to this as redacted dominionism. I argue that Genesis 1:26-28 indeed grants humanity dominion over creation based on the image of God in humanity, perfect, flawless. But then after the fall, that mandate is not repeated. In fact, it's adjusted. So the dominion mandate is noticeably absent when fallen humanity is given its marching orders post-deluge or after the flood. So the enduring role of humanity is not one of functional superiority to nature, but rather one of equal instrumental value with all other creatures. All creation serving the purposes of God rather than the purposes of mankind. Yes, sir?
What's the problem with the stewardship?
Okay.
Approach was?
The three major approaches, dominionist, stewardship, and maybe I'm being too grandiose in calling mine a major approach. It's not necessarily a major approach. Redacted dominionism. Dominionism, first of all, can't escape the accusation of anthropocentrism. It clearly sets mankind as the center of all things, and everything is to be utilized for whatever purpose man designs. That's an unfortunate historical interpretation, I think. The stewardship idea is a softening of the rule and subdue terminology in Genesis 1:26-28, two Hebrew words that are very well translated as rule and subdue, very strong words. And the idea is that really that doesn't mean governance. It instead references stewarding, kind of a gardener having a responsibility of gardening, taking care of. Now, many who would kind of fit my worldview, or, you know, they would agree with my worldview, would hold to, and I would say probably most would hold to that particular idea. It's not terrible, but I would simply suggest, because for me as a Bible expositor, an exegete, my focus in dealing with the Bible methodologically is hermeneutic consistency. So if there's any view that I'm holding to or working with that is not being consistent in applying the literal grammatical historical hermeneutic to the text, then I'm placing myself above the text and I'm starting to rewrite history, so to speak. So I'm trying to be faithful to that methodology. And stewardship, I would argue, fails slightly, but fails nonetheless in achieving that, because it redefines terminology And I would argue, there, by the way, are there good arguments on the other side? They would argue that it is an instance where it's legitimate that the terminology is seen as more metaphorical. I don't hold to that. I don't think that's fair. So I think it's inconsistent hermeneutically. And so being a literalist, meaning I'm looking at the biblical text trying to get its intended meaning in a literal natural sense, I'm looking for something more consistent. And the outcome of redacted dominionism versus stewardship is not very different. Just the vehicle of getting there is, I think, substantially different. Does that answer your question?
What occurs to me is that the concept of stewardship is more of a New Testament concept. If you consider the parable of the talents,
yeah.
And there are other
possibilities. Good. Yeah.
So it would seem that it's more biblical in a Christian sense, at least, to use the stewardship approach than it would be in the dominion.
Good. And you know what? I think you're correct. And I would say the idea of stewardship is a very biblical idea. Interpreting Genesis 1:26 through 28 as a stewardship passage is hermeneutically inconsistent, and that's the problem.
I follow what you're saying.
Okay.
But because you have the same problems with all kinds of concepts, from Old Testament to New Testament.
Well, and here's the thing. This is what I eat for breakfast. This is the stuff I love, because it's hermeneutic consistency or bust, right? And just to give you a little window into what I'm talking about, if the Bible is the Word of God, which is something that I espouse, and I understand that most wouldn't hold to that, if it is, then it should be able to stand on its own. It should be able to be coherent and cogent and consistent in all of this. So that's what I'm looking for, is I'm holding it to that standard, and personally, it meets those standards in my eyes. Now, in working through these processes, I see a tremendous consistency in the text, but because of an inconsistency hermeneutically, we haven't really, I think we haven't seen it. And let me just say, I'll get to your question, let me just say, in dealing with this particular view in the academy, what I found is people are receiving this as something they've never heard of, never even considered as a possibility, and are really impressed by the attempt at consistency. So it's something that you find in the commentaries, you find the view, this interpretation, it's just not brought into this context. So I admit, I'm not borrowing this idea from somebody. I can't point to, well, so-and-so makes this argument or that. This is something that I'm looking into text, I'm saying, here's the deal, I wrote a dissertation on it, and at least those that looked at that thought it had some merit. Now, that doesn't mean anything. That was just a logical fallacy of appeal to authority, right? I'm just throwing that out there as I'm trying to do something a little different. My goal is not to be different. My goal is to stand on the text and let the text say what it says, kind of disregarding a little bit interpretations that have come before, just to see, is there something we could have missed? If that makes sense.
I understand that. I think you have some real problems with trying to do this.
I understand.
And you know of these problems. There's reference to the concept of the law, yeah. Or the concept of sacrifice,
sure.
The concept of life after death, or, you know, all of these concepts actually change from the Old Testament to the New Testament.
As you go from pastoral to agrarian,
yeah.
There's a different set of ethics. The same way that if you divide the world into major crops, and then you divide the world into major religions, you have the same map.
I understand the issue.
It's the needs of the crops that divide the world.
Hang on one second. I want to get to this gentleman's question. We raised his hand a moment ago, but let me just say this. I appreciate the issues, and granted, the premises that I'm operating on, probably most in this room won't be operating on those premises, and that's part of doing philosophy, is examining other premises. I will say this. Those issues, those shifts, I would refer to this as the progress of revelation. I would not use the word change, and we can look at specific cases, but I think you see a flow of a narrative. So I understand the issue. You're very correct in bringing that up. Let me do this. You had a thought, and you had the thought, and I want to come back to you. So, yes, sir.
another thought I want to put forth is that even within the Old Testament, there is change in these concepts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's not Old Testament, New Testament.
That's
you read the Old Testament, and it changes
absolutely. And my point here, my very limited point, is that in Genesis 1:26 through 28, and the first nine chapters of Genesis, that what's going on there is not stewardship. That's all. That's my limited scope point here. Now, my assertion can be, if we look at like cases, we can have all kinds of discussions legitimately. But my point is very narrow and focused on hermeneutic consistency there. Yes, sir.
You had talked about the stewardship argument being inconsistent. Do you also see another inconsistency as far as look at our world and the amount of air pollution, water pollution, sound pollution, light pollution, so many animals endangered or threatened or extinct, that we have not a good steward is a gardener takes good care of his garden.
Right, right.
We're not taking good care of our garden.
Fair.
So in that sense, we're not a steward.
Absolutely. Well, you're using a descriptive idea, right? You're describing what is, and I would argue it's true. What we're trying to get at is the prescriptive. Whether we are or aren't good stewards isn't related to the fact of whether we should be stewards, right? So we're headed there, though. We're going to get there. We've got a few minutes left here in this. Okay. Excellent points. I know we're going to have a lot more of this in the Q&A. I might just talk and until we have to go home. That way you can't ask questions. I promise I won't do that. So, in any case, I would argue that based on these passages, taken from a very narrow hermeneutic framework, attempting consistency, in applying that method, the enduring role of humanity is not one of functional superiority, but rather one of equal instrumental value with all creatures. Now, all creation then would serve the purposes of God rather than the purposes of mankind. So theocentric rather than anthropocentric, right? Now, the first premise here then, with redacted dominionism, is land is community. Well, guess what? That's the same premise we saw in Leopold's non-metaphysical, naturalistically based environmental ethic. Land is community. That is not inconsistent with Genesis 1 through 9 literally interpreted. Okay. In redacted dominionism, all creation is described as a kind of community serving God's own purposes and does not differ dramatically from the essence of Leopold's first premise. Now, we skip the second premise and we go to the conclusion. Land should be loved and respected. Redacted dominionism is even compatible with the conclusion that land is to be cared for and respected beyond being human property. Ownership is God's, and while mankind may be entrusted with a kind of stewardship, in the same sense that any community member has a responsibility to that community, it's God's agenda that's at the center, not that of humanity. Certainly, redacted dominionism will not advocate that land should be the primary object of love and respect, but love and respect are appropriate nonetheless. And that's a difference between the naturalistic and metaphysical conclusions. In the naturalistic approach, the land as community, the community is kind of the highest good. In a metaphysical approach, a community is not the highest good, but it is a good. Now, while the first premise and the conclusion of the land ethic and redacted dominionism are not incompatible, they work well together, it's the second premise that determines compatibility with Hume's model and shows the contrast between naturalistic and metaphysically grounded environmental ethics. I characterize Leopold's second premise as follows. The spectator views the functions and contributions of the land to the community with positive sentiment and would view the lack thereof with negative sentiment. Now, redacted dominionism can abide the same premise with only one significant adjustment, the identity of the spectator. For Leopold, the spectator is everyone else in the community, okay, the biotic community, that everyone in the community has a certain moral sentiment about the action toward others in the community, land being an equal part of that. In redacted dominionism, I would argue, I'm okay with moral sentiment as a framework using Hume's ideal, but I kind of borrow Berkeley's idea of the ultimate perceiver, and that is that God is the spectator. He's the ultimate spectator. He is that third party that is qualified and equipped to make those moral judgments. This then makes this interpretation of Genesis, the early narrative, and the Judeo-Christian framework for both the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament, for both of these tracks, it sets a course for a theocentric environmental ethic rather than an anthropocentric one, which, by the way, helps the early Genesis narrative escape the anthropocentric accusations levied against it by the early environmental critics. So it's very intriguing in that respect. Somebody agrees with me. Just kidding. In short, it's possible to find common ground among metaphysically diverse environmental ethics. We just utilized a naturalistic framework of argument, formalized syllogism here, to consider both a naturalistic environmental ethic and a metaphysical environmental ethic, and we see how compatible they are with important but slight differences. And the importance lies in Hume would deny that the spectator I'm referring to even exists, so would Leopold, whereas in the metaphysical framework, we would suggest that there is the need for this particular spectator, that this spectator exists. So the metaphysical presuppositions are the differing points. They're the things that are dispositive, that determine the distinctions between these systems. But in these other respects, in the descriptions of reality and in the prescriptions, we can see a lot of similarities. So even when we have major metaphysical differences, okay, presuppositions that none of us can prove one way or the other, we can still end up at a place where we can stand side by side, disagreeing on where we came from, disagreeing on what we are, in fact, and still have some agreement on what we should do. And that's significant, I think. And that makes this study, I think, fairly useful and helpful for dialogue. Any questions or thoughts? None? Okay, see you later. Yes, my friend. Thank you. You're all awake, so I've achieved my goal. I appreciate your attention. I have no idea where we're at on time. So. How'd I do on time, by the way?
Good. Great.
Good.
Yeah, I got it. Based on universal moral sentiment, am I coming through?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Based on Hume assumes there is such a thing as universal moral sentiment. Well, it occurs to me that if you've got, say, three different worldviews, theistic, pantheistic, and naturalistic, now those are the three that come to mind.
Sure.
It would be doubtful of where you would have a universal moral sentiment. In other words, moral sentiment could be very different between those.
Right. And here's the thing. What Hume is trying to do. He's got one goal in mind, and that is to explain human experience without God, okay? And I think he's very successful at doing that based on a certain premise, right? What he's doing is he's trying to, in order to explain human experience, you've got to account for some aspect of right and wrong. Where Nietzsche denied there was any good and evil, you know, as an existentialist, he was all over the map, but he denied there was good and evil, saying there's no intrinsic good or evil. There's only, you know, productive or unproductive, right? Good or bad in terms of end games, almost utilitarian in a sense. Hume is not satisfied with that approach. Obviously, predates that approach. But what Hume is trying to do is he's trying to set up an ethical framework that can stand on a naturalistic metaphysical premise. In other words, with the presupposition that there is no God and there is only the material, the natural, he's got to have some way of accounting for right and wrong. And I think his is the most effective system at doing that. It does require assent to this principle that there is a universal moral sentiment And not that there's universal agreement on every moral aspect, but that there is universal moral sentiment. And where there are exceptions, those exceptions have been maybe developed, and I think Darwin gets into this even more, those exceptions have been brought out by society more than intrinsic in human nature.
Is he perhaps assuming his own naturalistic view?
Yes.
It would make some sense.
Yes. Yes.
If he doesn't allow theistic views.
Definitely.
Arpentius.
Definitely. And by the way, that's the grounds on which I disagree with Hume. I appreciate his system. I think he's the most effective in his system. He simply holds to a premise that I can't hold to. So obviously I disagree with his entire system, but I can borrow it and play with it and see where it ends up. Yes, sir. You
had... Oh, I was going to say, when it comes to, like you said, universal moral sentiments, I mean, hunter-gatherers don't have the Ten Commandments.
Right.
Nor do they need them.
Right.
Without our crops, those problems never come up.
Right.
And like I said before, when you divide the world into these moral sentiments, it roughly corresponds to the needs of the particular crops.
Exactly.
In fact, until we entered into symbiosis first with dogs, we had no gods at all. Dogs made God an economic necessity. In the same way that when they moved from a pastoral society of the Jews into an agrarian society, they had to adopt a different set of rules so that the wheat and the grape could come up every year.
Right, right.
And Christianity is, in fact, the set of rules that the grapes and the wheat put down for us. Something much bigger than we are. We can see our crops from space, which is more than you can say for human monuments and whatnot.
Sure.
So here we are following their rules. And like Jesus said, God is grapes and wheat.
Well, I'll put it this way. I think you, from that premise, I think you accurately describe what Darwin is saying, that we're adjusting to a world around us, and we determine, based on the needs of the tribe, what is good. And for Hume, he takes away the individual aspect so that the tribe makes the determination.
Right, and the only other species that exhibit what we consider humane behavior, and humane behavior perhaps we could call universal morality, the only other species that exhibit it are carnivorous pack animals.
Sure, sure.
Which is why wolves domesticated us in the first place.
I think your descriptions fit very well with that premise. I think that's good. Who's next? Yes, sir.
Well, first I want to compliment you on a remarkably lucid and well-constructed and creative presentation.
You're very gracious. I thank you.
He's right.
Good. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
I wish that was a preamble to a telling rejoinder, but it's not that clever.
Well, I'm waiting for the but.
I did want to point out that the real problem here is this issue of universality.
Right.
And you are attempting to create some by focusing on ways that people with your theological metaphysical presuppositions can limit the discourse to recognize a certain universality of agreement within the group to a somewhat tailored issue. And therefore it is something that has a great deal of promise for practical effect. The underlying fact about that is that it's necessary, because there is, in fact, a great deal of confusion and disagreement and myriads of different kinds of moral sentiments that are not a bit universal.
Right, right. And Hume's, we can have certainly a critique on Hume. And again, I'm borrowing Hume not because I agree with him, but because I find him useful. And in a particular context. My grand project, and then I'll come right to you in the back. My grand project is this. When I read the literature of environmental ethics, I see the Judeo-Christian worldview trashed. And in some cases, legitimately so. I mean, history is full of examples of just unfortunate things, right? But what I'm looking at a society, a pluralistic society, in which we have freedom in society to let's say, coexist, to operate side by side as a citizenry. And we have very different views metaphysically on things like the soul or eternity or any of these issues, the existence of God. We have very different views within this pluralistic society. And in some religious traditions, the approach is to convert or die. And I think that doesn't represent the biblical model, which I would argue is instead focused on the metaphysical aspect. For example, in a biblical model, if I'm looking at that as a cohesive revelation from God, I could argue that that the solution to man's problems is not government, it's not society working together, it's God himself, right? Now, in the meantime, while Jesus Christ, according to the Bible, sits in heaven and awaits a return, again, according to biblical prophecy, here we are. Now, we're not independent of God in that sense. As a Christian, I don't argue that. I simply argue that we're supposed to be busy doing things and a very specific set of things. And none of those things involve the persecution of unbelievers or the convert or die kind of framework. Instead, it's kind of minding your own business and being a good citizen. And that's a major part of it. So for me, this is an attempt to contribute to the discussion as a philosopher to be able to say, take a second look at the Bible. There are approaches, very legitimate, fair, even-handed academic approaches to the Bible that respect it at the highest levels that allow us to draw some prescriptive conclusions. And I'm not going to argue that that there's universality. And I'm not trying to say, see, Leopold on the naturalistic side and redacted dominionism on the biblical side, or the metaphysical side, perfect agreement, so there's really no disagreement between, you know, atheist and theist. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying, if we can see, if we can use a reasoned approach in an area like this, then perhaps there are other areas we can discuss as well. So I appreciate your comments, and I also appreciate the caution there. There will not be universal agreement. This is just one narrow area that I think can be a point of contact. Yes, sir.
The problem I see here is the question of value that the spectator is placing a value of this is good, or this is not good.
Right. Brilliant. I'm so glad you brought this up.
I'm a naturalist, a materialist. Uh-huh. You know, land is land. It's not good or bad. It's land. And men or women, humans, are humans. They're not good or bad. They just are.
Right.
And for a spectator to say, whether it's us as a humans or God, to say the land is good and therefore, you know, we should take care of it, blah, 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 that shouldn't enter into it. It's a matter of survival. It's a matter of, this is our canoe that we live in. You better take care of it or it'll sink. It's all in the garden. It feeds us if we don't weed it, water it, we're gonna
absolutely.
So I think you know, you're placing value on something that necessarily doesn't exist. It's just
okay.
It just is.
Let me challenge you in one respect.
At one point.
Okay.
And I don't ascribe this this idea of value to Judeo-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's cultural. And Judeo-Christian is part of that culture, but it's not a universal culture. The ancient Egyptians, the Pharaoh, owned the land. Everything. Everybody else worked for the Pharaoh. When the Europeans came to this country, to the New World, and they started, you know, blocking off their own farm, and they said, you know, this is mine. Indians couldn't understand that concept. How can you say
this river is yours or that land is yours. It's like saying the sky is yours,
right?
I mean, it belongs to everyone. So, you know, it's that this concept of mine and yours and whatever is cultural. It's not biblical. It's not Judeo-Christian.
Okay, so you're saying then that Leopold's critique is actually incorrect? Then.
Yes.
Okay, and that's fair. By the way, that's been a critique levied at him, that he is too narrow, and certainly, I wrote on Blaine White that he's too narrow. But when you talk about value, this is a very important point. You'll notice that I used the word instrumental value. The big discussion is intrinsic or instrumental. You hold to a brand of instrumental value, that it's good to you because it's your canoe, and if it sinks, that's bad for you. So the land has instrumental value to you. Now, what environmental ethicists have long argued is that everything has intrinsic value, not instrumental value, which I find, personally, I find that kind of impossible, because in order to have any value at all, you must have a valuer, right? You must have a valuator, which then demands instrumental value of some kind. So my argument is very specific, that contrary to the, let's say, the traditional Judeo-Christian argument, that people have intrinsic value, I argue they don't. They have instrumental value only to God, that they serve God's purpose. So if we want to say in practical terms that gives us intrinsic value because God says it was good, he's saying it's good for my purposes. We have to define what good is, right? So in that discussion, whether we're talking instrumental or intrinsic value is very important. How we define good is very important as well. And you just touched on several of the key themes in the environmental ethics discussion. And as you might imagine, and as I'm sure you're very aware, there are a plethora of answers and conclusions in this regard. Personally, I find it entertaining to be able to take a literal approach to Scripture, come up with a solution that the radical, completely atheistic environmental ethicists love the conclusion, but they hate how I get there, because I'm working from a metaphysical framework. I kind of enjoy that. It's a fun discussion. Yes, sir? We'll go to you, and then...
Well, I was just going to remark that you and I are completely opposite metaphysically. I don't even consider metaphysics a legitimate enterprise.
Perfectly fair.
What I'd like is that the way you put it, you and I can still stand together and, you know, protect this planet.
Right.
And that is what I got out of it. And that's what is important.
Right.
And the other point I want to make, nothing bugs me more than the Christian's concept of the Old Testament. I studied the Bible, so-called Bible, the Old Testament in Hebrew.
I call it the Hebrew Bible, and I study it in Hebrew
as well. And
it's
completely different than what these Christians talk about.
It is.
What the hell out of it?
Well, I'm with you. That's another area in which we agree.
It's no the Bible anyway.
and that's the point where
it's been translated.
Sure.
And there's so many books. What about the Apocrypha that's been thrown out? I mean, you can't talk about the Bible.
Excellent question. And a whole other avenue of discussion, right?
But at least we stand together on the damn environment.
Absolutely.
That's what I got out of it. That's what's important.
Fish club. Hey, there you go. Now, you don't see that every day, right? Yes, sir. Yes.
I still don't see how you get out of the realm of the cultural. I think you could just as easily say that coal has value as to say that land has value. Coal has value if you're in China and on the verge of starvation, and the fact that the air is completely polluted, but you brought all these people out of poverty and allowed them to be able to even survive. You could use it's hard to decide what God wants. Sometimes I'm a retired doctor, and we always got attacked for playing God, and it's not so easy to play God.
Absolutely.
So I don't know that coal doesn't have great value, despite what it does to the environment.
Let me make two real quick comments. I think your point is just dead on, but for two reasons. Number one, the argument you just made is exactly why I think the dominionist and stewardship views in practice are problematic, because we are not equipped to steward this. We make a mess of it. We have a very difficult time knowing what to do. So I think your point is well taken there. Secondly, the idea of coal having value, again, you have to get into the discussion of who's the one valuing it. Because if you get it right, and that's where there's difficulty, because one, the political parties on one side, they value the mining of energy everywhere it can be found for economic independence. On the other side, it's more of an environmental agenda. Well, there are different values, and that's the culture war. That's the political battle that's going on. And who's right? Well, I have my beliefs and opinions, but we differ in those in many, many areas, right? So we have to be able to understand these are core issues, right? But we have to be able to say, guess what? We live in the same country. If there is a God, he let us be on this planet together to walk together for this period of time, so we got to figure it out, right? And if there isn't a God, then that doesn't matter anyway. Let's just make it fun while we're here, right? So I think I'm not trying to discount for theists and those from a metaphysical framework. I'm not trying to discount the importance of spiritual matters and of the existence of God. I mean, that's my life, right? But I am trying to say that that as we see described in this book we call the Bible, there is a very clear description, cultural description, of people working together and functioning. So I appreciate your observation. Those two points, those two aspects, I think are really key to the discussion. I hope I haven't twisted your words and made you. Okay. Anything else?
Question? I have different metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, all the way down than you do. So
fair.
You've made statements like, we don't know what to do with the land. We just screwed up the land.
Overstating. Overstating.
Well, just saying there is that we don't know what to do.
I would say we're not fully qualified to understand all of these issues.
Well, only because of the Dark Ages, the 1,000 years of Christian Dark Ages, because the Greeks and Romans were on a roll.
I understand.
In 1,000 years of Dark Ages, I wish that the Greeks and Romans could have kept on rolling. I think we'd be flying around spaceships now. The 1,000 years of wasted.
Let me throw something at you.
But to the point, we all live great lives now. We've extended, doctors have extended the lives. We eat wonderful food. We travel the world. We live longer. So to throw out, we don't know what we're doing. We're screwing up the land. But in values, I go to values.
Fair.
Would you value the trees over a human? Would you value a lay perfect over a cure for cancer?
Okay.
Would you, where do your values lie?
If I'm consistent, I have to answer that a certain way, right? But let me first say, there's two points I want to hit. First is the 1,000 years of Christian. You see, that's where I think Lynn White, as a medieval historian, gets it wrong. It's not Christian. It was a political usurpation of a religious document. There's nothing like Christ in what we saw for 1,000 years. This whole convert or die thing, that doesn't bear any resemblance to the Jesus that's described in the biblical discussions. That's number one. I agree with you completely on the cultural disaster that was. I just say I attribute it to something different. Now, the second issue is I find myself, in getting into this discussion, kind of being lumped into the group that says there's this great ecological crisis and, oh, woe is us. I'm not in that group, okay? I happen to believe things are broken, but not because we're messing it up. I think things are broken because of a spiritual issue long ago. That's a whole other discussion. But
you're referring to the ball.
Yes, absolutely. So what I would say is, while we are not fully equipped to steward a world or to have dominion over a world, yeah, we have all of these things that you talked about, and I think they demonstrate very well the capabilities that we do have, but they are limited. I mean, you admit that. I mean,
no,
we still die.
They're not limited. Not that we don't. We're not omniscient. We're not
Well, then it's limited. I mean, you're going to die at some point, right?
Yes, sir.
So if you're going to die at some point, then there's a limitation on your capability. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Now, that's a tremendous... Where we're at, and we can have a discussion about technology versus nature. We've come a long way in many respects. I wouldn't argue that. And I'm not one out there saying, the world is on fire and we got to fix it. My approach is a different one entirely. My approach is to say we need to be responsible. And that's the biblical mandate, is to be responsible, understanding that we are here using someone else's property. That's the grounds for responsibility. Not that we're to redeem or fix anything. As I mentioned earlier, a biblical response to that would be that he's the one that's going to fix it. There's no claim that we can, in our brokenness, fix it. So,
while we live together on this earth, and a political vote came down, and
yeah,
take down the forest,
and if we
take down those trees, we can come out with a cure for cancer. So
I would
vote for trees or man.
I would chop down the trees and put them in my Hummer.
Well, you have to look at it too. The first major environmental catastrophe was when the Greeks in 500 BC got the iron plow and denuded the entire Greek peninsula, which used to be trees, are now where only goats can live there even to this day because of what they did.
If I may say, here's the key issue. The issue is of priorities, and how do you determine one good versus another? Is it good to not infringe on a rainforest? Of course that's good, right? Is it good to leave things as they are? Yeah. Is it good to help humanity? Yeah. So how do you determine when you're forced to choose competing goods? And this is where that impartial spectator comes into play. I would say, what does God value? When I look at these texts, how do I turn, and what does he do?
It was that first environmental catastrophe in Greece that led to the worship of Apollo, which is what he's espousing.
Yeah, we had another question in the back, or...
Okay, one last question, then concluding remarks, and then we'll...
Okay.
One more question.
Last question.
Okay, any concluding remarks?
We're going to have some offline discussion, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. You can contact me anytime. The email is ccone@tyndale.edu, or even after the discussion. I'm all yours. So anyway, I really appreciate your hospitality and the discussion. A whole lot of issues. And I'm just getting started. So thank you.
My next book is about the education of the world.
That was good.